government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulations.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion. That's how much business
and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the 18th episode of the Free Lunch podcast of the Regulatory Transparency Project at the Federalist Society. Visit the RTP website at regproject.org, regproject.org, to subscribe to our newsletter and to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. My name is Devin Westhill. I'm the director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch podcast. This Free Lunch podcast is about how the Department of the Interior interprets the 1918 Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Specifically, does this early 20th century law prohibit accidentally killing birds? During the final 10 days of the Obama administration, the DOI said it did, but current DOI leadership thinks otherwise and recently moved to permanently withdraw and replace the Obama-era interpretation. Here to discuss why the action was undertaken, what effects the earlier interpretation had or could have had, and what effect the DOI's new interpretation will have is Gary Lawkowski. Gary is counselor to the deputy secretary at the DOI. Prior to joining the department, Gary served as legal counsel to a national nonprofit organization and counsel to to Chairman Lee E. Goodman and Vice Chairman Don McGahn at the Federal Election Commission. Gary earned his JD from the UVA Law and his BA with high distinction from UVA. If you'd like to learn more about Gary, go to regproject.org. Shortly, I'll turn this floor over to Gary. Before I do, I remind everyone that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore all expressions of opinion on our Free Lunch podcast are those of our featured speakers. Also, Gary's happy to take questions after his remarks, so please be prepared with any questions that you might have prior to the start of the Q&A period. Gary, it's a wonderful pleasure to have you here as our Free Lunch podcast guest today. Thanks for being with us. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you very much for that introduction. As Devin mentioned, I'm Gary Lawkowski. I'm counselor to the Deputy Secretary at the Department of the Interior. So our story today is the story of how a nearly 100-year-old law, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, turned nearly every American who owns a cat, drives a car, or owns a home into a potential criminal, and what this administration is doing to restore the rule of law. To tell this story, I'll begin with what the Migratory Bird Treaty Act is, then give a little bit of background on how we got here, and finally, what the legal opinion of the department issued just before Christmas did, and sort of where we go from here. So what is the Migratory Bird Treaty Act? What does it do? In relevant part, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, or MBTA, you know, in government we love acronyms, so it's the MBTA, makes it a strict liability crime to pursue, hunt, take, capture, or kill a migratory bird. Now, migratory bird is a term of art that's expanded from a relatively small number of species that used to fly back and forth between the United States and Canada, and now includes over 1,000 different species, which is practically every native bird in North America. Violations of the MBTA are misdemeanors. They are punishable by up to 6 months in jail and up to a $15,000 fine. However, there are a couple of catches with that. First, the government has traditionally taken the view that every dead bird is a separate violation of the act. Now, that may not be a big deal in the hunting context. You know, you have to sit there, you have to aim, deliberately kill each and every bird you want to kill. That makes some sense. But it becomes a very big deal where you're talking about this type of incidental or accidental conduct, particularly in the industrial context, which we'll get to a little later, where a single action can kill dozens, if not hundreds, of birds. Thus, by its plain terms, the fines and potential jail time can add up very quickly. Second, the fines described in the MBTA are not necessarily the fines you'll have to pay. What many people don't realize is that the federal government has a general statute on criminal fines that explicitly supersedes the fines set forth in the law describing the underlying offense, unless the law exempts itself from this general provision by a, quote, specific reference. All of which is a complicated way of saying that the $15,000 fine specified by the MBTA is not necessarily your potential exposure. For example, the general provision allows a fine of up to twice the gross gain or loss as a result of a criminal offense. So following the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, BP pled guilty to a number of offenses and paid very large fines as a result. Included in that, though, was a single count of violating the MBTA. Remember, a single count generally means you killed one bird. One bird, one count. For that single count, which nominally carries a fine of up to $15,000 based on this separate general law, BP was fined $100 million, or over 6,000 times the supposed maximum fine. And again, this is in addition to the other fines and penalties that BP had paid or was assigned under this guilty plea that totaled in the billions. Finally, a third and somewhat hidden way the government comes through these types of charges is through probation. You may look at the statute and think, all right, the maximum sentence here is 6 months. After a few months, I can put this whole incident behind me. However, there's another generally applicable law that allows up to 5 years of probation for federal misdemeanor offenses. In other words, while you can only spend up to 6 months in jail, if you're found guilty under this, the government can be sort of tracking you and sort of in your business in a very real way for a long time. So now, where did all this come from? Where did this law come from? Around the beginning of the 20th century, conservationists were concerned that overhunting, particularly hunting associated with what was called the plume trade, which was the use of birds and their feathers and hats, other outfits. So if you see those sort of old pictures, black and white pictures with someone wearing what looks like a bird around them, that's the type of thing we're talking about, was driving many species to the brink of extinction. As a result, Congress passed an earlier version of this law called the Weeks-McLean Law, as a predecessor to the MBTA, and sought to limit migratory bird hunting. At the time, though, regulating wild game was generally thought to be the province of the states. And the Weeks-McLean Law ran into constitutional challenges on federalism grounds almost immediately. So to get around these issues, scholars and eventually lawmakers developed a different theory, that by acting under the treaty power of the Constitution, the federal government acts with authority of the United States in a way that Congress, sort of acting on its own and adopting a law, did not. This places treaties and their implementing legislation on a different constitutional footing than other traditional laws. So in order to get around some of the constitutional concerns that had arose out of Weeks-McLean, in 1916 the President signed and the United States ratified the Migratory Bird Treaty. At the time it was with Great Britain acting on behalf of Canada. And in 1918, purporting to act under the authority of this treaty, Congress adopted the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. This approach was subsequently blessed by the Supreme Court in a case called Missouri v. Holland. That's a case that, perhaps not surprising for a group of Federalists, remains somewhat controversial these days. Thus, the MBTA was originally aimed at and understood to be aimed at regulating hunting, and even that limited assertion of federal power was incredibly controversial in its day. Because of that, it's highly unlikely Congress thought it was doing more or that Congress thought it could do much more than just regulating hunting in that context. So, what changed over time? Well, Ronald Reagan once said, "A government bureau is the nearest thing to eternal life we'll ever see on Earth." Over time, wearing large birds on your dress as a sartorial statement fell out of fashion, as it were, and the danger posed by overhunting receded. And you may think, that's great. It sounds like a resounding success. Let's pack it in, go home. Seems like we're accomplishing what we set out to do. But unfortunately, that's rarely how these things go. Beginning in the 1970s, government began prosecuting people and companies for bird deaths resulted not from hunting or poaching, but from unintentional or accidental conduct. Generally, industrial or agricultural activities, such as maintaining a wastewater pit, or spraying pesticides on crops. Now, this change was not accompanied by any change to the underlying law. The relevant part of the MBTA was last updated in 1936, following a new treaty with Mexico. While there were changes in the 70s to other parts of the MBTA as a result of subsequent treaties, they did not affect this sort of taking, hunting, pursuing prohibition. Thus, what we had in the 1970s is the administrative state deciding on its own and without legislative guidance, hey, we think there's a problem here, and concluding that in spite of over 60 years of history and the difficulty Congress had in enacting this type of law in the first instance, they've had the power all along to subject wide swaths of the American economy to federal oversight. Now, this new theory was not without its detractors. Over the years, it's attracted a mixed record in court. Some have accepted the government's theory, usually with some sort of limiting construction, such as it can only apply to extra hazardous activities, it can only apply to direct and foreseeable consequences, while others have rejected it, saying, no, looking at this law, looking at the text, this only applies in the hunting and poaching context. As a result, today there's a deep circuit split regarding incidental take. Into the breach and filing a stinging rebuke from the Fifth Circuit stepped the Obama administration. On their way out the door, almost literally in January 2017, the Obama Department of the Interior doubled down on their theory of incidental take, issuing a legal opinion concluding that accidental bird deaths may be criminally prosecuted if the death is, quote, direct and foreseeable. Now, that interpretation and sort of the history behind it going to the 70s is how we got to a place where a nearly 100-year-old law turned every American who owns a cat, drives a car, or owns a home with windows into a potential criminal. This interpretation, combined with the strict liability nature of the law, results in a stunningly broad universe of potential criminal conduct that includes many everyday activities. You see, the biggest man-made threats to migratory birds are not oil pits, it's not power lines, it's not windmills. According to the Fish and Wildlife Service, it's pet cats. And it's not even close. The next two biggest threats are collisions with buildings, which kill approximately 300 million birds per year, and collisions with cars, which kill approximately 200 million birds per year. That's nearly three times the next leading cause. Based upon these numbers, it's eminently foreseeable that things like buildings and cars will kill birds, and anyone who's watched sort of an old cartoon can tell you it's eminently foreseeable that cats may. Further, it's hard to imagine an action that is more direct than driving a car under continuous human control. It strikes and kills a bird, but is still accidental. That's not the purpose of the activity. That's a very direct activity. Nor is this wholly a hypothetical scenario. There have been prosecutions for people driving into birds, albeit intentionally, and there have been cases where the Fish and Wildlife Service has reportedly asked states to remove flowers, say, on the side of a road, under threat of MBTA enforcement because cars were striking and killing birds who were attracted by the flowers. In other words, the limits that the Obama administration and others have touted as protecting the American people from regulatory overreach are not actually limits at all. So, in practice, nobody wants to prosecute every building owner or every car driver. Even proponents of the law recognize that's absurd, that's not what we really want to do. So what happens instead is government relies upon prosecutorial discretion to pick who it will go after and who it will leave alone. And look, most prosecutors are very good people, and I think we've picked some great ones in this administration who will use their discretion well. However, as Madison wrote, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, no external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. Unfortunately, prosecutors are not maybe really good people, but they're not angels. Thus, the Supreme Court has time and time again rejected the suggestion that prosecutorial discretion is sufficient to protect against broad statutes that may be applied in absurd situations. Further, the focus on actual prosecutions misses the more pernicious effect of a law like this. And that is, it's used as a backdoor for imposing quasi-regulatory requirements on people without going through the notice and comment process or providing clear, understandable limits of what is and is not legal. As we write in our opinion, this broad interpretation hangs the sword of Damocles over a host of otherwise lawful and productive activities. As Justice Marshall recognized, the value of a sword of Damocles is that it hangs, not that it drops. What this means is that a broad interpretation like this sweeps a wide array of conduct, from potentially driving a car or planting flowers to where you sight a windmill and other commonplace occurrences, and allows government to use the threat of prosecution to coerce what it wants from its citizens. Because the MBTA is a strict liability statute, you have no choice but to either give in or risk prosecution. There's no option to actually comply with the law on your own. And I mean, I come from a culture where you seek to comply with 100% of the laws 100% of the time. Because of the way the MBTA is structured and because of the strict liability statute, that's not possible in a lot of industries, including many that are very valuable to the United States and to its economy, such as power transmission, communications towers, windmills, oil and gas. It's just not possible to have a situation where you never accidentally kill birds. Now, to be clear, this is also not some fringe theory these crazy Trump people have cooked up over here at Interior. To our critics, this is a feature, not a bug. Now, they couch it in slightly different terms. They couch it in terms of leverage. We need this broad interpretation in order to have leverage over industry to get them to do what we think they should be doing under the guise of so-called voluntary guidance. You know, we're just providing voluntary guidance to help them figure out what they should do. Now, maybe you think industry should do some of these things, but we have a process for imposing mandates on our citizens, and it requires democratic accountability. It requires Congress to pass clear laws and agencies to enact clear regulations so that reasonable people of ordinary intelligence don't have to guess at what's required of them and aren't put in a position where they can't comply with the mandates coming out of Washington. Now, we're here today thanks to the Regulatory Transparency Project. When we talk about regulatory transparency, one of the things I think we mean is the hidden regulatory effect of interpretations like this. So here's what happens in practice. The Fish and Wildlife Service gets word that your project may accidentally kill birds. If you're lucky, you're in an industry where you've already developed voluntary guidance, such as it is, which gives you some idea of what Fish and Wildlife will ask you to do. If you're not lucky, or if they think you're not doing enough, they can ask you to take additional steps or make changes to your project. Now, none of these things are actually found in the text of the law or in formal regulations. If you open the U.S. Code, you're not going to find these mitigation requirements. Thus, if I'm trying to start or run a business, I have no way of knowing what's actually going to be required of me until Fish and Wildlife shows up and says, hey, you need to do X, Y, and Z. That's a hidden regulatory burden. It's something I can't account for ahead of time. And again, now these measures are called voluntary. And I use a slightly interesting tone on that because DOJ has been very open that one of the main factors they look into in assessing whether they will prosecute you is, did you do what Fish and Wildlife asked? That sounds a lot like, would you please do X, and a lot more like, do it or else. Thus, the degree to which these sort of voluntary guidelines are really voluntary is at best open to debate. Worse still, and perhaps worst of all, even if you do everything that Fish and Wildlife asks of you, you can still be prosecuted. Remember, the MBTA is a strict liability statute. Unless you have a permit, if you kill a bird, you can be prosecuted, regardless of what other steps you take. When the Fish and Wildlife agent comes and says, I want you to do X, Y, and Z, doing those things does not actually protect you from liability in any sort of legal sense. It merely curries favor with the prosecutor and hopes that they'll leave you alone. This point has been hit home by a number of defendants, including some cases where they took remedial measures or they took mitigation measures and found themselves prosecuted anyway because someone concluded, well, that wasn't really enough or you didn't do it quick enough. This point is also hammered home in the voluntary guidance documents issued by the Fish and Wildlife Service, which exclaim, quote, it's not possible to absolve individuals or companies from liability under the MBTA. Thus, this heads-I-win, tails-you-lose approach is fundamentally incompatible with due process. It says, we want you to do X, we're going to make you do X, and if you do X, hey, we'll still prosecute you anyway if we find you're a bad actor, we don't like you, we don't like something about you. And at the end of the day, this approach erodes compliance and respect for the rule of law. So, what did we do? In late December, we issued a legal opinion. This opinion looks at all of this and says, no, the MBTA does not properly reach accidental conduct. Rather, it is properly limited to affirmative actions that have as their purpose the taking or killing of migratory birds, their nests, and their eggs. Now, like all good textualists, we get there first by looking at the text and the common law history of the words used. The words in the MBTA generally connote purposeful action. For example, you don't accidentally hunt or pursue something. It's something you have to do with a certain degree of purposeful conduct. Further, the statute builds on a common law foundation that the late Justice Scalia helpfully laid out in one of his opinions, which shows that words like take were more than just passive conduct. We then look to the legislative history, some of which I talked about a little earlier. This showed that the focus for Congress was on overhunting, and that even this focus was extremely controversial. Because it was controversial, and because it wasn't clear that Congress had the authority to even do that at the time, it's since been resolved by the Supreme Court, it's highly unlikely that Congress intended to adopt the sweeping prohibition some now read into the law. Finally, we look to the sound principles of constitutional avoidance. Even if we assume, you know, maybe the law is ambiguous, the courts made it clear that we're duty-bound to adopt the interpretation that avoids grave constitutional doubt. Because this broad incidental take interpretation leads to potentially absurd results and leaves people of ordinary intelligence to guess at what's really required of them, we believe it raises those types of grave constitutional doubts that are to be avoided. Now, what does this do? So this opinion is binding on the department. The result is that the Fish and Wildlife Service will no longer investigate or participate in incidental take prosecutions under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and no longer require mitigation measures based on the MBTA as a condition of granting a permit or other sort of approval from the department. Now, what this does not mean, though, is that all incidental take prosecutions or concerns are gone with respect to birds. There are a number of other laws that also operate in this field at the federal level, including the Bald and Golden Eagle Act and the Endangered Species Act, that have implications for incidental take. Now, those are distinguishable in a variety of ways. First, again, we look at the text. In both the ESA and the Eagle Act, Congress defined take in a broader way that departs from the common law. Further, at least in the case of the Eagle Act, there is a mens rea requirement that we don't have in the MBTA. To be outlawed, the taking of eagles must be done knowingly or with wanton disregard. Now, there's certainly some room to debate what wanton disregard means in practice, but at least there's that limiting condition in the law itself that can sort of help constrain and prevent some of these absurd results. It's not a strict liability offense. Now, this also shows that where Congress wants to apply this type of standard, it's more than capable of doing so. One of the critiques we've received is that we should have applied a gross negligence standard to the MBTA. But whatever you think of that approach as a policy matter, that's just not the law that Congress has given us. The law we have is a strict liability statute, and that strict liability statute would lead to absurd results if we go there. Now, the other distinguishing feature between the ESA and Eagle Act and the Migratory Bird Treaty Act is the scope. Both the ESA and the Eagle Act apply to a far fewer species than the MBTA does. So where does that leave us for the long term? So in the long term, we're assessing how to properly implement this change. Look, trying to change a long-standing government policy is like trying to turn around an aircraft carrier. It can take some time and effort. So we're working on developing more specific guidance for close calls so that we can help allow the industry and allow our enforcement people in the field to understand, hey, here's what's expected of you under this interpretation, here's what you need to do, and provide some clarity for both sides to make sure everyone understands what are the parameters and basically the basic expectations. So thank you all very much for taking the time to listen to all of that, and now I'll be happy to take some questions.
Hey, thanks a lot, Gary. I never thought I'd be so interested in the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, but this is really enlightening, and I appreciate your remarks. I think this goes, much deeper than what a lot of folks are giving this issue credit for. And I have some questions of my own, but I'm going to open up the line to questions see whether or not we have any questions in the audience. So in a moment, everyone on the call is going to hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode's been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. Let me open up the floor now. Okay, the floor request mode is on. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you can ask your question or answer the questions in the order in which they're received. And we've got quite a few questions already, so I'll hold off on my question.
Okay.
And maybe we'll have some time at the end or not. So, caller, when we get to your question or when you hear the prompt, you can ask your question.
Yes, this is Michael Doyle with E&E News. Are there any ongoing or were there any ongoing Migratory Bird Treaty Act prosecutions that have now been put on a hiatus because of the new opinion?
Not that I'm aware of, but we'd have to double check with DOJ to confirm that. As I understand it, so the Obama administration put out their opinion in January 2017. When the new administration came in, one of the first things that was done is to suspend that opinion pending further review. My understanding is a lot of those prosecutions under the MBTA were sort of put on hold or put on the back burner after that suspension. So I'm not aware of any, but I would have to double check with DOJ to confirm that.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question. Thanks for the answer, Gary. I think this actually warrants a follow-up question, which is what industries were being prosecuted or what businesses were I don't want to say being targeted, but were running afoul or being found to be in violation by enforcement entities?
So it's generally, and this is with a very broad stroke, I'd have to pull specific numbers from Fish and Wildlife to give you a more specific answer, but generally it's been the energy industry and it's been infrastructure type projects. So it's been things like oil and gas, it's been things like wind farms, it's been things like transmission lines, it's been things like communication towers that seem to feel the brunt of the prosecutions. Now, again, I'd have to pull the specific numbers to quantify that, but that's been where the perception's been, and that's been what the Obama administration even was looking at when they talked about trying to find a regulatory fix to some of this, which they were not able to actually do. And again, one of the bigger problems with this isn't even just the actual prosecutions that you see. That's just the end of the chain. One of the bigger problems is this hidden regulatory burden you get before you even get to the prosecutions, where this provides a way for basically the government to ask you to do whatever they want you to do and then say, even once you've done that, we still reserve the right to prosecute you.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, one of the things that we're very much interested in with the Regulatory Transparency Project, and we have an entire working group on this, is the ability of regulatory bodies to coerce or or enforce regulations in such a way that it becomes overly burdensome to even plan for different industries. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you quoted from the DOI memo that the value of the sword of Damocles, right, is that it hangs, not that it drops. And it's interesting that I've heard some critics of the recent move by the Department of the Interior is that it was rare even to see prosecutions, but it's that the sword hangs. And it strikes me as though this is not a partisan issue, that both Democratic and Republican administrations can succumb to the temptation to use coercive powers in inappropriate ways to achieve their policy goals, and that, you know, both sides of the aisle should be concerned about this sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, this has been something that's happened under both Republican and Democratic administrations.
Yeah. Well, great. Let's go to the next question now.
Hi, this is Esther Whelan with S&P Global Market Intelligence. I was wondering if you, Gary, if you could provide more details on what you're considering doing in terms of guidance. Do you have a sense of, in addition to that, do you have a sense of kind of what format those guidances could take? Like, I'm not quite sure how they would be issued or how they'd be public. And then also timing. And then you mentioned ESA in the Eagle Act. Are you contemplating similar guidances or legal interpretations or rulemaking changes for those related to birds?
So this opinion does not directly address the Eagle Act or the ESA. So those things continue as they did before. They're still the same. We have not made any changes to that and to those regulatory programs. In terms of forthcoming guidance, it's probably going to take a little bit of time before we get something specific. I think the first priority is going to be sort of providing that guidance internally and then assessing where we are and what types of things we need to provide that publicly in order to make sure people are aware of sort of what we've provided and what we're doing. I think we're still discussing what our options are and sort of what the best format to get that out is, and if there's a way or need to get sort of public comment on that. And once we've settled on that, I anticipate we'll move forward, and I anticipate that'll be over the next couple months.
Thanks for the question, and thanks for the answer, Gary. I'm going to make another call for questions. If you have a question, to enter the queue, all you need to do is enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll get to your question in order that we receive it. I'd like to make a brief announcement while we're waiting for questions. Everyone on the call, please mark your calendars. Next week, the RTP will host two more free lunch podcast teleforums on Tuesday, January 23rd. Dr. Patrick McLaughlin of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University will discuss his recent study with Duke University professors Bentley Coffey and Pietro Pieto, examines a regulation's effect on firms' investment choices and consequently on economic growth. And on Wednesday, January 24th, we'll be joined by former OIRA counselor to the administrator Paul Noe and Deputy Associate Attorney General at the U.S. Department of Justice Stephen Cox. Paul and Steve will address the proper and improper use of guidance documents by regulatory agencies. Please mark your calendars. Okay, I'll make. I don't see any questions in the queue. I do see one question, but if we only have one other question, I'll ask Gary if he has any final remarks thereafter, and then we'll hang up our spurs here. Call when we get to your question, or get to you. You can answer ask your question.
Yeah, Michael Doyle again from E&E News. You saw the letter signed by the 17 former Interior Department officials concerning the opinion. How do you respond to their criticisms?
We certainly respect them, and we respect their collective experience in this field. However, I think they're wrong on this issue, and I think they're wrong for a couple reasons. One, they want us to turn this law into something it's not. So they mention in the letter sort of, okay, you have this law, you should be applying this different standard, this gross negligence standard here, that nobody thinks that this law should apply more broadly, and that the Migratory Bird Treaty Act doesn't prohibit these types of absurd results. But that's just not the law that Congress gave us, and I think we have to apply the law that Congress gave us. And also, I think it gives into this sort of temptation to take too much power into the federal government and sort of wield that power as leverage over the regulated community in a way that prevents them from really being able to plan ahead of time and understand what's expected of them ahead of time. You know, it goes back to that leverage issue that people want us to use the Migratory Bird Treaty Act as a mitigation statute, but again, that's not the law that Congress has provided. What they've given us is a strict liability criminal statute, not a statute that calls for those types of judgments. And that's evident when we look at some of the other laws that do allow those types of things. I mean, the ESA is an example. The Migratory Bird, or I'm sorry, the Bald and Golden Eagle Act is another example of laws that have some of those flexibility and have some of those provisions. So it seems that they're just sort of trying to transform this law into something it's not, which is, and I understand the policy rationale behind it, but again, that's not what Congress has given us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gary. We'll go on to our next question now. If you have a question, just enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll put you in the queue. Caller, when we get to you, you can ask your question.
Hi, my name is Dennis Webb. I'm a newspaper reporter in Grand Junction, Colorado. Thanks for this. I'm just wondering, I'm trying to understand to what degree the action you're taking aims at undoing what the Obama administration did versus really going back further and trying to change what basically it sounds like has been going on for a couple of decades now. It sounds like your action goes further than just unwinding the Obama action. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Now, there have been some intervening events, though, in the meantime. For example, there was a circuit court decision during the Obama years that basically adopted the interpretation that we've set forth in this opinion. And that was a bit of a change from some of the other ones. It was a little clearer that, hey, this incidental take theory really can't be applied under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, including to sort of industrial activities. I think some, including in the Obama years, had the view that some of the other courts of appeals that had ruled on this and that it said the Migratory Bird Treaty Act only applies in the hunting and poaching context, we're really talking about it in the habitat destruction context. So what changed during the Obama years was we had another court of appeals that came in and said, no, we really mean hunting and poaching context. It's not just limited to habitat destruction. It's also industrial activity. So yes, it goes back further, but at the same time, it's partly because there have been intervening events.
Thanks, Gary. We've got another caller in the queue for a question. So caller, when we get to you, you can ask your question.
It seems like this is part of the heritage of the FDR administrative state, where the administrator becomes a rule writer, enforcer, and judge and jury. But this act was passed before there was such a thing as an administrative state, and there's nothing that says that the commissioner shall create rules to enforce this act. So how do they bootstrap themselves into this position of being able to go after non-hunting activities?
It's hard to say. I mean, at some point in the 70s, someone came to the conclusion, hey, we've never used it before, but we've had the power all along, just in 60 years. Somehow no one's happened to notice that or recognize that. It's one of these cases where you almost click your heels together three times and realize it's been inside you the whole time to get back home.
Gary, great answer, and thank you for your question, caller. I'm going to make one last call for questions. If you have a question, enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. If I don't see any questions, I'll ask Gary if he has any final remarks, and then we'll hang things up. Seeing no final questions, Gary, would you like to give any final remarks before we're finished here?
I'd just like to say thank you all for taking your time. I know, especially for those of us out near Washington, it's a bit of a snowy, cold Wednesday, so I appreciate you all taking your time to listen to us.
Well, thanks so much, Gary. It's a pleasure to have you as a guest on the Free Lunch Podcast of the Federalist Society. On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, I want to thank our audience as well. Great questions. Thanks for joining us. Until next week, so long.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers. And you can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.